I'm Leah Simone Bowen, the host of Podcast Playlist on CBC. We're a podcast discovery show, and we love a great story. So each week, we highlight the podcasts we think you should check out.
The show is a classic.
Love how they select their topics.
It's great.
And from time to time, we're joined by some of the biggest names in podcasting.
My name is Jamie Loftus.
John Green.
I'm Michael Hobbs.
My name is Nicole Byer, and I have a podcast recommendation.
You can find Podcast Playlist on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Ever since he was a kid, Rufus Wainwright wasn't one to just fade into the background. That's how he described it when he was telling me about growing up in this famous family of folk musicians where everyone could sing and there was an air of competition. Now, I have been a fan of his for a long time, and I gotta say, the origin story that Rufus shared really helped me understand in a new way how he ended up sounding the way he does. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. You're listening to Q. When you hear the name Rufus Wainwright, you kind of can't help but think of that go big or go home approach. So just relax again, let them all come out. Rufus is so well known for maximalism that it's easy to forget he comes from one of the royal families of folk music. The long line of Wainwrights and McGarrigles have helped shape popular folk music for the last half century. And on the eve of his own 50th birthday, Rufus has decided to go small and go home with a brand new album called Folkocracy.
High on a rocky ledge lives a maiden.
Rufus revisits a handful of folk classics alongside some incredible collaborators, folks like David Byrne, Sheryl Crow, Chaka Khan, John Legend, and his own family join him on this album. Folkocracy is out today, and I got to speak with Rufus Wainwright about it. Hi.
Hello.
Hello. So this album, I understand, is kind of an early birthday present of sorts for yourself leading up to kind of a significant birthday this summer. Do you want to say?
Yeah, what? Yeah, no, I'm, well, we're having a birthday party show on July 13th in Montauk, New York, where my husband, Jorn, and I have a summer place. So, and I'll be playing in front of the lighthouse, which is very beautiful with the Atlantic at my back, and it's going to be very sunny and gorgeous.
Yes.
And that's open to the public. And so anybody, you know, come on down or over or up or whatever to there. But then my actual birthday is July the 22nd. And I'll be turning 50, and I will actually be on stage, in Dublin at the National Concert Hall doing this concert, the Folkocracy concert, there. So it's, yeah, there's a few events.
What a way to ring in a significant birthday. I know some people get really freaked out about milestone birthdays. Yeah. How are you feeling about it?
Well, I've always chosen to work on birthdays. I much prefer that. This is my, you know, comfort zone. Just and it is a lot easier, I have to say, than having to, you know, I don't know, have a hosted party and you do a dinner and, you know, act like you're not crumbling inside. I don't like birthdays. Let me just say that. Any kind of angst like that is great for singing, and it's great for performing, and great for, you know, just making music and stuff like that.
Okay, yeah, yeah, good. Yeah. So before we get to the album, I want to go sort of way back. As I mentioned in the intro, you grew up in a family that is synonymous with folk music. Could you share your earliest memory of music in that house?
Well, my earliest memories of music were, well, I mean, first of all, I mean, my mother, Kate McGarrigle, would sing to both Martha and I every night. Very dark, brooding, rather violent lullabies, you know, and So it started with that. But then there was, you know, there was always music in the house. I think the main sort of thrust of it was that our grandmother, Gabby Lachamoy, or Gabby, eventually the Gabby McGarrigle, I think she had had certain aspirations for the stage. You know, she loved to perform. She was a good singer. She was very funny. I think she would have loved to have been a dancer or something, but that was just out of the question, you know, for a woman of her generation and from where she came from socioeconomically. So it just didn't happen. And so then I think years when Kate and Anna became performers, a lot of that was sort of reawoken in her, and her home in Saint-Sever up in the Laurentians became a bit of a stage. The living room became kind of a stage, and every weekend when we would be with her, the whole family would sort of create this floor show where all the kids would do something, and you know, Kate and Anna would do something, and then of course the big finale was always Gabby singing some kind of racy, you know, music hall song from the turn of the century or something. So I think a lot of it is because of our grandmother, Gabby.
Beautiful. What would a song that you would have sung at that time be?
Well, I would always do Some Over the Rainbow, or I would sing a lot of Irish folk songs like The Minstrel Boy. And then there was more kind of pleasant, funny things like My Grandfather's Clock. And then there was a lot of French songs as well. Mm. À la Clairefontaine and La Madelon and stuff like that. So there was that was another thing too. It was completely bilingual. There was kind of equal French, equal English singing, which was nice.
You're painting this joyful picture of just a family, and people are probably picturing just
joyful. I would say it was joyful, but it was also pretty intense. I mean, there was a lot of competition. If you speak to Martha, certainly it was a rocky ride for her. Because I was totally game and I was being the oldest and the boy in this sort of family of women. I was very much the kind of apple of everybody's eye, and I was so eager and frankly good. So I kind of took up a lot of space, and Martha would come down and sing, but I think a lot of the other cousins felt a little overshadowed by my mother and I and our kind of, you know, intense musical love affair. But I think it did fuel them nonetheless, you know, especially Martha in her, in her own direction and her own sensibility. And she, you know, and she'd kind of go upstairs and brood and listen to Leonard Cohen and then come down and sing a song and then retreat and come back down. It was, it was an interesting, period.
The brooding, the word brooding has already come up like three times. We've only been talking for a few minutes.
You
said that your mom would sing you dark brooding lullabies, and I just love the image of that, brooding lullabies, and then like, okay, good night. That probably shapes you as a person a little bit, I would think.
We have a 12-year-old daughter, you know, when she was a little kid, about 3 or 4, and just starting to understand, you know, stand stuff, I started to read her German fairy tales, like original Grimms and all of that. And, you know, because my husband's German especially. And I do consider it one of the great experiences of my life, was to rediscover those stories and how much it equated to, you know, my mother's kind of dark songs, because there is a kind of, I don't know, there's something about that. They're really engaging and very violent and very intense and magical. And so it's, I don't know. I'm so thankful, because it could have been so boring.
Yeah.
I think it's mostly to entertain the parents that those stories are so weird.
Oh, for sure. But they're magnetic to kids, too, because you don't know that they're supposed to be interested without feeling like there's something wrong by being interested in something that's dark.
Yeah.
So coming from this amazing folk family, it would have been easier, maybe at least expected, for you to follow the same path as your mom or your dad or your grandma. Both your parents celebrated folk musicians, and then you end up going more towards pop and opera and classical music.
Yeah.
Did you feel any pull to stay in the folk world when you were carving your early musical path?
Not particularly. mainly because I was, you know, my conversion to opera was I was very young. I was 13. And I really went whole hog for that type of music, and I think it actually turned off quite a few people in my folk or in the folk world. I mean, my mother appreciated it eventually, and she actually became a big opera fan herself. But my dad has never liked opera, and a lot of people too didn't really understand it. The folk world is very heterosexual, very how can I say this? Very I wouldn't say working class, but there's a kind of, you know, there's a communistic, you know, the people kind of thing going on. Mm-hmm. And so I think opera was considered quite elitist and snobby. So it kind of went the other way. I think they appreciated my talent, and they also knew, you know, they wished me well. and there were some similarities at times, but I didn't, I was pretty hell bent on going my own way.
In defiance of the folk, the sort of, I mean,
slightly. I mean, I appreciate tremendously the my upbringing and the folk, the experience that I had, you know, singing that music and being at those festivals and hanging out with those musicians. I never felt like I fit in, and it was mainly a gay thing. If I was a lesbian, it would be a completely different story, because there has always been a real connection between the lesbian community and folk music. It's like a long tradition. But for gay men, it wasn't easy to, you know, there was me and Ashley McIsaac. That was it.
But that's so interesting. So what, you and Ashley, what made you want to come back to it now?
The music is great. The music is great. Also, I feel now that there's a kind of, I know. I think in this world that we live in now, which has become so, mechanical and also so digital, and certainly know what's going on with AI and stuff. There is this aching need to just have, you know, these human experiences and just to create something that is, I don't know, just that is warm and inviting and flawed.
Yeah.
Slightly, you know, so there's and I think you eventually do go back to your roots as you get older.
One of the best shows of the year, according to Apple, Amazon and Time, is back for another round. This season, we're diving deep into some of McCartney's most beloved songs. Yesterday, Band on the Run, Hey Jude. And McCartney's favourite song in his entire catalogue. Here, there and everywhere. Listen to Season 2 of McCartney, A Life in Lyrics on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to talk about the title, Folkocracy. How did you come up with that?
I came up with that. How did I come up with that? It was my friend Neil Tennant from the Pet Shop Boys. Mm-hmm. He's a friend and a fan of both me and my family, and comes to, and loves folk music himself. But he was talking about various different folkocracies, you know. There's mine, we're also good friends with the Thompsons, like Richard and Linda Thompson and Teddy Thompson. And so that's the Thompson folkocracy. And then there's, you know, the Seeger folkocracy. Hmm. There's these different families who are the Carters and so forth. So it's, he was the one who coined it. When I went to Spain recently, they call it Folko Crazy. Folko Crazy. Which I also like. I like it just as much.
It's really good. It's really good. Okay, well, let's play one of the songs from Folko Crazy and talk about it. We'll start with this one. Here we go.
Down in the willow garden.
from his new album, Folkocracy. That is Rufus Wainwright and Brandi Carlile, two iconic voices, oh boy, together in the song Down in the Willow Garden. You've called the song a brutal and masochistic murder ballad. So why did you want to sing it with Brandi Carlile?
Well, I felt it would be, I had to do it with a woman. That was sort of the only caveat, because it is, you know, in a pretty rough. But that being said, you know, it's, I don't know. It's, there's something with a lot of folk songs. There is, and this one certainly has it. There's something about the tune that is fascinates the listener, and they can't quite tell why. It's a strange ingredient. It's like a secret ingredient that is undiscernible or undefinable. And this song has that power. You know, for instance, my daughter, once again, when she was a little younger, you know, I'd sang this song. And she wanted to sing it. You know, she's just gravitated towards it. You get it a lot from children, what songs have this and what songs don't. And this one just has it. It has that frequency.
Beautifully said. Okay, here's another song.
And we'll all go together to
from his new album, Folkocracy. That is Rufus Wainwright getting the band back together, so to speak, with Anna McGarrigle, Chaim Tannenbaum, Lily Lankin, Lucy Wainwright Roche, and Martha Wainwright. That song is Wild Mountain Time. You really have the feeling listening to that of exactly what you said, of capturing time and capturing a moment. How did this one come together?
I was doing a show in Montreal. Look, initially there was talk of maybe going to Montreal during the making of this record and spending a couple of weeks and really, you know, digging into that beautiful, you know, situation up there. But then I realized, you know, I kind of want this to be my own angle, you know, my own sort of perspective. And I'd like to do the family thing at some point again, but this is about me at the moment. But then once the record was done, I was like, you know, it would be stupid if I don't have the family on, you know, in a really, you know, in a profound way. So I was in Montreal during a concert, and, you know, I had the day off after the show. In fact, my voice sounds pretty destroyed on that recording, but and they all, you know, gathered and we went into the studio and cut the track. I'm really happy that track's on there. It's very important, and it's the last song on the record. So that shows.
You have your longtime family friend Chaim Tannenbaum playing your late mom's banjo on it.
Yes, my mother's banjo is on the album, which was I knew that was a big deal, because you know, the banjo for her was, I think I would say, it's, I don't know if it was her favorite instrument. I mean, she loved probably the piano the best. But she was a magnificent banjo player, and I always associate with her. She used to play it a lot for me as a child, I'm really happy that it made it on the record.
Was it emotional to stand around with your family and sing it and have him playing your mom's banjo and the whole thing, the last song on the record?
I think so. I don't think we knew it was the last song at that time. You know, we hadn't really sequenced it yet. But I don't know. It was emotional. I think I was actually quite exhausted, though, in general, from having toured so much. So I was just, I kind of leaned a lot on them, you know. I think what's nice about the songs, you know, I sing the beginning and I do a verse, but then I kind of give it to them, you know, and Lucy sings beautifully, and Martha and Lily and everyone, and Chaim. So it's sort of, it's almost like the family holding you up a little bit and keeping you afloat, which they're supposed to do.
I have to think that making this record and that song in particular has given you a moment to pause and to look back at your roots and your family legacy as you're about to turn 50. Has making this particular album changed anything in how you look back at that part of your story?
Well, it has made me realize that I would like to do a little bit more with family. Because even, during one thing is that, I mean, COVID was so tough on Canada. I mean, I was in LA for most of it, for pretty much all of it, and I couldn't go to Canada for many years, and there was just, I don't know, it was, a lot of relatives died who were older, not from COVID, but just, just time passed, and my uncle passed away, and some friends and stuff,
I'm sorry.
and so it's sort of, I don't know, there's a tenuous thread up there. So I'd like to come back up and spend more time and do, make, work with my family again soon.
Well, this is a really beautiful record. Congratulations and happy early birthday. I hope that
Thank
your
you.
show is a wonderful way to celebrate.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. It's always fun to talk to you,
Okay.
Rufus. Yeah.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye.
From his brand new album, Folkocracy, which is out today, that's Rufus Wainwright and Anoni with a new take on Rufus's classic song, Going to a Town. Before that, you heard my conversation with Rufus Wainwright. All right, that's it for this episode of Q with Tone Power, the podcast. I would love for you to check out the other episode we've got up today. It's a conversation with Chloe Van Lanschoot. I got to talk to her about something you don't really hear about too much in the entertainment business. She is a nurse who plays a nurse on TV. And when she got the part, the producers of the show she's on did not know that she had this real-life connection. You can find that on our podcast. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. I'll see you around.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.